in Alberta, Canada, where the Great Plains give way to the foothills that eventually become the Rocky Mountains. There is a 33-foot high cliff that is called, it's named Head Smashed In Buffalo Jump. Anybody ever heard of it? Anybody? Zero. We were eating lunch yesterday with Todd and Wendy Riker. They worship at Cedar Park. Todd is actually going to start preaching. So he was asking me about, you know, where do you get some of your introduction, your stories, you know, and introduce you? And so I told him, I said, well, you know, I'm using one tomorrow. I said, it's Head Smashed In Buffalo Jump. I said, have you ever heard of it? He said, yeah. He must be pretty widely read, but Head Smashed In Buffalo Jump is a place, a location that for centuries indigenous people of the plains killed bison by driving them off of this cliff that runs for about 1,000 feet in length. The Blackfoot that we know more specific information about would drive them from a grazing area that was a couple of miles from the cliff, and they would drive those bison with into what they describe driving lanes, and they fashioned these driving lanes out of hundreds of piles of rock that would eventually funnel that herd of bison to this cliff. They would employ specialized buffalo runners, young men who were dressed up as coyotes or wolves, and they would locate the few lead bulls of the herd, and they would compel in those bulls a sense of panic. And when those lead bulls began to run, even though there was just a few of them initially, the herd would follow and there would be this stampede of bison as the rest of the herd simply blindly followed those who had established the lead, and they would be driven off of this cliff. And in the fall, they would break their legs, they would be rendered immobile, and the injured bison were then finished off by warriors who were stationed at the bottom of the cliff armed with spears and clubs. They even had a processing facility, if you will, at the foot of the cliff. And it provided everything that they needed, and then as you can kind of see in the picture here, including running fresh water. According to legend, this location was so named because of a young Blackfoot, that wanted to watch from below as the bison plunged off of the cliff. You can see this is not a good idea, right? And as legend has it, when they found his body, it was under a pile of bison carcasses and his head was smashed in, hence the name Head Smashed In Buffalo Jump. And there's actually a museum and everything that's here that you can go and tour. Now, seems like an odd place to start a lesson. What it illustrates and what I want us to understand is that bison are not the only creatures that are susceptible to panic and fear. And the Blackfoot tribe are not the only ones to use that panic and fear to their own benefit. People can be prone to panic and anxiety and hysteria and knee-jerk reactions, and everyone from Satan to politicians to advertisers can use that fear and panic to achieve their own purposes. But as Christians, that shouldn't be us. That we are people who in our world should remain calm in the midst of crisis. Because we serve a God who is not only in control, but a God who loves us with an everlasting love. And that must always be the lens through which we look at life. And as a result, rather than surrendering to fear, rather than adopting a herd mentality, we find our hope and we find our peace of mind in a powerful yet loving God who is able to deliver and to protect us. And that brings us to Psalm 91. Let's read the psalm in its entirety. Psalm 91, beginning in verse 1. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. For it is He who delivers you from the snare of the trapper and from the deadly pestilence. He will cover you with His pinions, and under His wings you may seek refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and a bulwark. You will not be afraid of the terror by night or of the arrow that flies by day, of the pestilence that stalks in darkness, or of the destruction that lays waste at noon. 1,000 may fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not approach you. You will only look on with your eyes and see the recompense of the wicked. For you have made the Lord my refuge, even the Most High your dwelling place. No evil will befall you, nor will any plague come near your tent. For he will give his angels charge concerning you to guard you in all your ways. They will bear you up in their hands, that you will not strike your foot against a stone. You will tread on the lion and cobra, the young lion and the serpent you will trample down. Because he has loved me, therefore I will deliver him. I will set him securely on high because he has known my name. He will call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will rescue him and honor him. With a long life I will satisfy him and let him see my salvation. This is a psalm that actually is referred to as an orphan psalm. That's the category that it fits into. And that simply means it's a psalm that we don't know who wrote it and we don't know the occasion or the time frame of when it was written. What we do know about this psalm is that it is a psalm with which Satan himself was familiar. In fact, Satan even quoted it, even though he very likely despised the message that it conveys, and he himself sought to distort what this psalm means. The psalm appears to be a response to the previous psalm. And if you're familiar with Psalm 90, you'll notice, and if you turn back there, you'll notice that in the superscription, this is a psalm that is written by Moses. And, of course, it has in it the familiar line in verse 10, as for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years. It's a psalm that begins with the eternality of God, and it moves to emphasizing the brevity and the difficulty of human life. But now in Psalm 91, we see sort of the counterpart to that, where the writer now draws our attention to God's protection, even in the midst of great adversity. And so these two psalms don't contradict each other, but instead they reflect realities that are a part of human life and a part of the life of faith. That on one hand, in Psalm 90, it's important for us to understand that God is eternal and we are not. That our existence is fleeting and it is challenging, and that's just a part of the human existence. But on the other hand, Psalm 91, those same people must also grasp the truth that God's presence in their life makes a difference, especially in times of difficulty and hardship. That there is much about this song that can fill us with incredible comfort and peace, as it reminds us in a very powerful way that only in him can we find real security as we look to abide in the shadow of the Almighty. Now, as we read through that psalm, I hope you were paying attention and noticed that there were a wide array of images that were used here that supply us with courage and assurance. It is a message that exhorts us to place our total trust in God, and that thereby we are equipped to put our theology on display in a world that is driven by fear and is running toward the cliff and sometimes even jumps off of the cliff. So let's study together this ultimate security that the psalmist talks about. You'll notice in verses 1 and 2 that it starts with this remarkable proclamation of faith. He uses some very vivid and graphic images to convey his decision to trust in this God above all else, and to encourage his readers to do exactly the same thing. You'll notice, for example, that in the first two verses there are four designations that are used for God. Each one of them conveys something unique about God's person and God's power. And so the first one we see is translated into English, Most High. And in Hebrew is Elyon. It's found 36 times in the Old Testament. And what it describes is God as the one who owns it all and the one who is above all. He is the Most High. There is nothing and there is no one that is above him, that he is the possessor of the heavens and the earth. And thus the emphasis on possessor. The word Almighty translates the Hebrew word Shaddai, and the idea behind this name is that God's not just a living God, but that he is a giving God. It speaks of provision, that he is the one who supplies our needs. The word Lord there in verse 2, you'll notice, is in all capital letters. That indicates this is the Hebrew word Yahweh. And to the Jew, this was the greatest name of God. In fact, they didn't even pronounce this name. This is the great I Am. This is the eternal, unchanging, covenant-making God. And thus the emphasis here is on that of promise. And then the last designation that's used, the last title, is translated God at the end of verse 2 there. This is the word Elohim. It is a plural word. It's found more than 2,700 times in the Old Testament. And the first occurrence of it ties it to creation. And thus what it is conveying to us is that our God is the all-powerful creator. He is the one who has absolute power and rule. And just in the first two verses, the psalmist is emphasizing to us, look, this is who our God is. This is the one who is protecting us. This is the one who promises to deliver us. You'll notice that there are also four metaphors that are used in the first verse to describe this God, this person of safety. That God, first of all, is our shelter. It's a word that speaks of a place of concealment. I think the Old King James, I think, rendered it hiding place. The New King James renders it, if I'm not mistaken, secret place. God is our shadow. That is a place for us to get out of the punishing heat of the desert sun. And then the two images in verse 2 have military overtones to them. The people of the ancient world lived under a constant threat of invasion by neighboring powers who would come in and employ brutal tactics, and thus it would compel great fear. But the psalmist says, God is my refuge. That is, He is my place of rest, and He is my fortress. This is a place of defense. And you'll notice that the writer doesn't say that these are things that God gives, but rather these are what God is. That in Him alone, we find rest and defense. We find shelter and shadow. That the truths about God, by way of these four designations, these four metaphors, compels then the writer to proclaim his total trust rather than doubt, his overwhelming confidence rather than fear. He says in verse 2, I will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. God doesn't remove him from an environment of hostility, but what he does do is he promises to preserve and to protect him in the midst of it. So this is not a case of isolation. It is instead is describing insulation. And then notice the two verbs here that are important. The first one, he who dwells, it's a word that means to remain or to sit, and therefore it carries this idea of permanence. But an idea of permanence that requires an attitude of a continual awareness of God's presence. And so we learn from the very first verse of this song that there's a conditional element to this, that God is only these things to those who choose to dwell in Him, that it is particularly for the dwellers, if you will, as opposed to the non-dwellers. More than that, we find that this writer, the second verb is to abide, and it means to lodge, to pass the night. It carries more of the idea of a periodic rest, a sojourn, if you will, along the way of our travels. And so the writer is encouraging the reader here to consciously and constantly find their ultimate security in the protective presence of this God. And this is something that in the first few verses he tells us that he is resolutely determined to do himself, and he is seeking to engender that same level of confidence in those who would sing this song from that day forward, that God's protection is assured regardless of a variety of dangers. And that's where he goes next. He describes for us some of the threats in verses 3-8. He says, it is he who delivers you from the snare of the trapper and from the deadly pestilence. Here the psalmist, he starts off by describing these lists of dangers that have the power to destroy and thereby to bring terror into our lives. I'm told that in the Hebrew, the word he in that verse, in verse 3, is emphatic. For it is he alone, he and nobody else who delivers you from that. That we place the proper object of our faith is in God himself. The first threat that he mentions here is the snare of the trapper, probably not intended to be taken literally, but what it has in mind is any kind of a man-made threat. The second one hits a little close to home these days, doesn't it? And from the deadly pestilence, an endemic disease. And understand that the promise here is not that we'll never find ourselves in trap, that we'll never become sick. The promise is that when we are, God will deliver us from that. In response to these threats, he also promises in verse 4, he will cover you with his pinions, and under his wings you may seek refuge. That like a mother bird looks to protect her young by harboring them under her wings from attack, God does much the same thing. The last line in verse 4, his faithfulness, that is his reliability, is a bulwark, a shield and a bulwark shield. We kind of get that. It protects the soldier's body. Bulwark, not a word that we typically throw around in our modern vernacular. The Hebrew word has the idea of a surrounding. And so maybe think of a fortress of some kind or an impregnable castle, if you will. As the writer continues in verse 5, you'll notice that he references other dangers that can also target us. An unnamed terror of the night, the arrows of military attack, the invisible danger of rampant and deadly epidemics, again, hitting rather close to home in our day, or even a plague that happens at high noon, right, in broad daylight. And yet, notice what he says in verse 5. You will not be afraid. And you will not be afraid, even though the extent of the devastation is visible all around you. Verse 7, 1,000 may fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not approach you. The point of his graphic imagery here is that we need not be engulfed in fear and anxiety. Even though the future may contain untold perils, we trust in a God who is powerful, who is in control, and who is gracious, and therefore our lives can be marked by assurance and not apprehension. In verse 9, he provides us with a marvelous promise of further security. You notice how verse 9, for you have made the Lord, my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place. I'm told here that in the Hebrew, the word you now is emphatic. For you have made the Lord. The psalmist's refuge, the psalmist, the Most High. You've made what started out in the song as the psalmist's dwelling place has now become ours, is what the psalmist says. And when God is a refuge and a dwelling place, we find an even more far-reaching promise that is provided to us. It expands now beyond the specific perils discussed in the previous verses to an even broader promise that's made. And that is in verse 10, that no evil will befall you, nor will any plague come near your tent. That's a remarkable and encompassing, all-encompassing word of assurance. And the allusion here seems to be back to the land of Egypt, when you remember that the houses of the Egyptians were struck during the night of the Passover, where those who lived in Goshen, those who were protected by the blood, they were delivered from that night of death. The reason for this fact, that evil will not befall us, that no plague will come near our tent, is further added in verse 11. Because here we're told that God has charged his angels concerning his people to guard where they go, to guard them in what they do and in how they live. And this one verse opens up to us, our minds, a world of mystery, of supernatural creatures that are sort of beyond our comprehension and understanding. Creatures who, according to Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 14, are sent to minister to those who will inherit salvation. And we could go on a great tangent right here, but we won't do that. You'll notice that they are said to bear up believers in their hands. That idea, this idea of lifting someone, is a rather common figurative expression of protective care in the ancient world. And this idea of not striking their foot against a stone would seemingly include not just stumbling over a stone, but it would include all kinds of harmful and painful events. And God has promised the protective care of his people because he employs supernatural, invisible agents to help him with the task. And yet, because they are unseen, those who render aid to us, We have a tendency to neglect them, to forget about them, to ignore them. And therefore, we often think that we're all on our own and we look to guide or to protect or to somehow formulate our own plans instead of trusting in God and His agents. In verse 13, you'll notice that the psalmist extends this idea of divine protection even further. You will tread upon the lion and cobra, the young lion and the serpent you will trample down. It's as though if God's supernatural agents protect His people so that they do not stumble and fall, they are able to continue walking, but more than just that, that they are able to trample down all hostile forces. Now, this song, when it was, depending on when it was written, this element may have actually literally applied to those who, for example, were involved in the Exodus from Egypt. Or perhaps if it was written later, those who returned from exile in Babylon and came back to the Promised Land. But eventually, these words came to take on more of a spiritual sense. That God, as we live out our purposes, His purposes in our lives, that He protects us from even hostile environments. And lions and snakes, again, would have been literal perhaps to the original readers of this song as they engaged in physical travel through the wilderness. But for us, it would perhaps be more symbolic that God protects us using His angels from various dangerous forces. Some of those forces are ferocious and powerful like lions, and some of them are subtle and deceptive like serpents. The point of the imagery that's used in this section is that the righteous aren't merely survivors. They're triumphant over their troubles. They're victorious over their enemies. And then notice in verse 14, because for 13 verses, we have heard from the psalmist himself, and he's spoken directly to us. But you'll notice in beginning in verse 14, and going down through the end of the song, that now we actually hear from God himself. That in the previous verses, the psalmist has made several statements of faith about God's protection, but now we find statements that come directly from God about the very same topic. And it seems that with these words, there's this, or that this shift in speaker is intended to bring us to an even higher level of security and certainty. That it's one thing to be encouraged by a human writer, even though he is inspired to believe in certain things. It's something else, if you will, to hear from the lips of God himself. And notice what he says in verse 14. Because he has loved me, therefore I will deliver him. God's speaking here. I will set him securely on high because he has known my name. He will call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will rescue him and honor him. With a long life I will satisfy him and let him see my salvation. Were you counting? Notice all of the phrases, I will. All of the promises, I will. There's six of them. If you're into highlighting or underlining in your Bible, notice all of those. The first is a promise of deliverance, and it's made to those who love the Lord. By the way, this is, in Hebrew, is a very unusual and rare word. It means to cling to be attached to desire. And so the promise of deliverance is made to those who are devoted to the Lord to the extent that they affectionately cling to Him. The second is a promise of security that is made to those who have known His name. And remember that His name is an indication of His entire being, His nature, His works, who God really is. It describes something that's close and personal. And the promise for them is that He will set them inaccessibly on high, where he will be unable to be reached by his enemies. There is the promise of answered prayer to those who call upon him. There is the promise of his presence to those who are in trouble. There is the promise of rescue and honor to those who know that he is with them even in times of trouble. And then the last promise is a promise of longevity. Remember what Psalm 90 was? Psalm 90 was about the brevity of life. Here's the counterbalance to that. Longevity of life. And it's for those who choose to dwell in his shelter, to abide in his shadow. There is this assurance of long and satisfying life, as well as the experience of his salvation. And thus there's some tangible manifestations of God's never-ending providential hand at work in our lives. Among the book of Psalms, the largest category or genre of Psalms are the laments. And in a lament psalm, What it typically has as a part of it is some sort of accusation or statement that God doesn't see, that God doesn't care, that God is somehow absent from the psalmist's life in a particularly difficult situation. But the assurance that rings out loudly from this psalm is that God is never absent from those who take refuge in Him, even when you are in great distress. That this God does deliver, that He does lift up, that He does hear our prayers, that He does protect us, that He rescues, honors, blesses, and saves those who love and acknowledge Him. And so where Psalm 90 says, look, life is short and it's full of difficulty, this psalm closes with a marvelous promise of God that He will satisfy His people with a length of life and that He will help and protect them along the way as they flesh out that long life. Now, anyone who reads this psalm should also understand that this psalm is not promising that the believer will never encounter trouble, that their life will always be easy. The promise is that even in the midst of those difficulties and challenges, God will be present and God will protect. But to interpret this to mean an unconditional kind of protection so that we can do something foolish or ungodly or dangerous and nothing is going to happen to us is to misinterpret the song. And how do we know that? Look over at Matthew chapter 4. Because in Matthew chapter 4, we find one of just three occasions when Satan actually speaks in the Bible. I'll let you cogitate on the other two when that occurs. Here's one of them. And here, Satan actually quotes from the psalm that we have been looking at, and it transpires, of course, in the temptations of Jesus. So look at Matthew chapter 4, beginning in verse 5. Matthew chapter 4 and verse 5. Then the devil took him into the holy city and had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple. And he said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up so that you will not strike your foot against a stone. Jesus said to him, on the other hand, it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. The promise of God in Psalm 91 is an assurance that he will keep the faithful safe wherever the pathway of obedience might take them. But Satan tries to make this song say something that it doesn't. In fact, the quote here actually leaves out some very important words from the quotation. You'll notice that Jesus does not ever correct Satan's assertion about what the passage generally meant. And that is that God will protect those who are His. That truth is certain. What Jesus is correcting is not the meaning of the psalm, but Satan's application of the psalm. And he does so by quoting Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 16. And thereby he brings balance to what's told and taught in Psalm 91. Satan claims that the promise of God in Psalm 91 is that he would protect those who are his, and that part was true. But the insinuation is that he will protect them even to the point that if you go, Jesus, and jump off the pinnacle of the temple, God's going to protect you even then. And Jesus points out the intention of the psalm. And that is that trusting in the God of Psalm 91 should never be confused with testing the God of Psalm 91. That to live recklessly or carelessly or faithlessly and then expect God to bail us out when we hit times of trouble, or that we force His hand in order to prove something about God to us or to someone else, is the height of presumption. And Jesus didn't need to do that to trust in the veracity of Psalm 91. He knew that His Father was going to protect Him. He knew that His Father had the power to deliver Him. And so He doesn't need to jump off the temple at Satan's urging by quoting Psalm 91 to somehow prove the veracity of what we're learning in Psalm 91. And the aim of the psalm is to encourage all of us to employ a quiet and simple trust in God, regardless of how threatening the circumstances are. It's not, that psalm doesn't encourage us to become spiritual kamikazes. Where you go, you know, in our day, you know, there's people that we got, you know, I mean, there's people to all different places with all of this COVID stuff. You don't go sniffing or licking doorknobs and saying, God's going to protect me. Okay? That's not what this psalm means. But it does mean he'll protect us. It does mean he'll deliver us. It doesn't mean we'll stay alive. Look at Daniel. We'll close with this. Daniel chapter 3, we find a marvelous example, I think, of three men who understood the truth of Psalm 91. In Daniel chapter 3, you'll remember that this is a chapter that focuses on Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And the context here is that the king, Nebuchadnezzar, has formed this golden image, and that he has instructed all of those in the entire kingdom that when they hear certain sounds of a plethora of instruments playing, that the response is to be that you bow down and you worship the image that Nebuchadnezzar had made. And Daniel's three friends refused to do that. But notice what they say. Chapter 3, beginning in verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of the blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. Notice that God is going to deliver us. We believe that he's able to deliver us from the burning fire. We know he's able to deliver us from you. They continue. But even if he does not, verse 18, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. These three men understood that God's intervention into human affairs is, to a large extent, mysterious. Yes, God promises to save. Yes, God promises to deliver. Yes, God intervenes to help in the lives of his people. But how he does that and when he does that is entirely up to him. And it is always in keeping with his plans and his purposes. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were men, I believe, who correctly interpreted Psalm 91. God is able to deliver them. They understood that. They trusted that to the extent. Do you hear panic? Do you hear fear in their voice? Or do you hear confidence? Do you hear assurance in their voice? At the same time, they also understood that for reasons known only to God, they might die this day. They might burn up in that furnace. We're still not going to serve you. We're not going to bow down to this image. The great promises of Psalm 91 should supply us with courage to live by faith. Not to respond with fear or panic, not to blindly follow others off of the cliff, if you will, as we started out with, but to confidently, not in who we are, but in who he is, to confidently face whatever danger, whatever peril, whatever obstacle, whatever enemy we might encounter, because we have chosen to dwell in the shadow of the Almighty. This morning as we close, is that where you're dwelling this morning? Are you finding shelter under the protection of his wings? Is he your refuge? Is he your fortress? Is he your shield? Is he your bulwark? Is he your shelter? And if not, he invites you to become, to follow him, to find those things in him, to trust in him. So this morning as we close, if you're not a child of God, no better time than right now to obey the gospel of Jesus. You need to come to Jesus trusting in him, what he accomplished on the cross, what he paid for in his shed blood, the hope that we can have in his resurrection. And upon your understanding of all of those things, be willing to change the direction of your life to confess that he is Lord. Not me, not anybody else. Jesus is Lord. And upon that confession, be buried in water for the remission of your sins and be raised to walk in newness of life. If we can help you to do that this morning, no better time than right now. Won't you come? Why together we stand with Josh and Sarah.